Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 4th of June. This hour of the program, we'll be talking about President Barack Obama's much-awaited speech in Cairo, in which he said, "We meet at a time of tension between the U.S. and Muslims around the world. I have come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world, one based upon mutual interest and mutual respect, and one based upon the truth that America and Islam are not exclusive and need not be in competition." He talked about his own background, which when you think about it is still quite extraordinary. "I am a Christian, but my father came from a Kenyan family that includes generations of Muslims. As a boy, I spent several years in Indonesia. As a young man, I worked in Chicago communities where many found dignity and peace in their Muslim faith." The president had response to his address from various communities, and we will be talking about that and the substance of his very long speech. It was 54 minutes. I'm sure many of you have had a chance to hear some of the excerpts, or perhaps you had a chance to hear the whole speech. Joining us this hour is Salam al-Mariati. He is the Executive Director of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. He speaks to congregations at community-sponsored events, temples, synagogues, churches, high schools, and college campuses, has written extensively on Islam, human rights, democracy, Middle East politics, the Balkan crisis. His articles and interviews appearing in the Wall Street Journal, LA Times, Christian Science Monitor, Chicago Tribune, and many other papers, and he has appeared extensively on television and on radio, has been deeply involved in interfaith activities. We'll be welcoming phone calls, and our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send us an email, you are ever so welcome to do that, and that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Salam al-Mariati, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
It was a long speech, wasn't it? He can talk, but he talked for a long time today.
Well, it was long, but I think as you can tell, if you watched it, it was riveting, and the audience was following every word. And at times, they were euphoric in response, and at times, you could hear a pin drop. So it was definitely a momentous, historic, and remarkable I wouldn't say speech, but I would call this a moment of history for all of us.
Mm. And what is historic about it?
It's the first time an American president has used his pulpit, the most powerful office in the world, to begin a new course, a new path between the United States and the Muslim world. And it's the first time, I think, that a sitting president has produced and offered an alternative narrative in terms of U.S.-Muslim-world relations. Typically, it was based on war in Iraq, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but I think he spoke about social reform, he talked about women's rights, he talked about so many other issues that I think are critical, even though they may not have been a major part of his speech, but I thought there were very important nuggets in his speech that we need to latch on to.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, it still is striking to me what his background is, and that we have elected as a leader of the free world a man with his background. Is it that the fact that he has this personal narrative that makes his speech even more compelling? I mean, it's a rather unusual personal background.
It is, and I would consider this part of our destiny here in America, because he really represents America, that diverse background, not only in terms of religion, but in terms of race. And I think that's exactly what America is. He is, I believe, the worst nightmare for bin Laden.
Mm.
I think today bin Laden was dealt a severe blow, because he was the only one that was articulating some of the grievances of the Muslim world, because Muslim rulers do not, and do not do it in an effective way. And while the president was offering a critique of Muslim world politics, I think he was also extending a branch of mutual understanding and laying out the framework for the common ground, and basically challenging the Muslim world, saying, if you want to define relations based on opposition to America, then you will get nowhere. But if you want to define relations on the future, based on the future and what we can do together on a common ground, then there is prosperity and hope. I think that the violent extremists in the Muslim world became more isolated. And indeed, the president said that in his speech, that he wants to partner with Muslim communities around the world to isolate the extremists, because U.S. policy until his administration came to power was isolating the communities.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think about violent extremism? Has it been on the wane since this president has been elected and since bin Laden has kind of lost a pulpit? Or do you see an increase in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan that worries the world, worries the Muslim world, and particularly worries the U.S.?
No, I still see it as a problem. I don't think it's worse. I don't think it's better. I think it's still the same in terms of the threat level, in terms of the attacks, not only against American interests, but against Muslim populations and Muslim communities. I think what's happening in Pakistan is self-explanatory in terms of the damage and destruction that violent extremism is causing the Muslim world. I think we got a long way to go before we can say that the situation will get better. The difference is you have an American president now that can speak to the root causes of those issues, as well as using America's military force.
The president talked about the seven major sources of tension: violent extremism, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Israeli-Palestinian conflict, nuclear arms, democracy, freedom of religion, women's rights, and economic opportunity. Would you agree that those are the sources of attention? When we talk about the Muslim world, there are a lot of countries here. Are there different sets of grievances quite distinct when you look at, say, Saudi Arabia, and you look at Egypt, and you look at Jordan, and you look at Iraq, et cetera?
Well, there are definitely different local manifestations of the same problem. The commonality of all these countries is the problem dealing with authoritarianism and autocratic rule. I think because of that, there's a sense of fear in challenging authority, fear in freedom of thought. I think it's changed considerably over the past few years. However, I still believe that that's a major problem, not just in terms of U.S. Muslim world relations, but in something internally within the Muslim world that has to be addressed. And that's why some of the comments he made, if he talked about the Quran, you'd hear applause. But when he talked about social issues, it was very quiet. And possibly that's because there's still that fear of the authority, what to do. Here he is talking about democracy and change. And anybody who would stand up, it might be singled out by the government. So there are many different problems, but the problem of authoritarianism is what's the commonality. And I think the president did very well in terms of speaking to the people and not having the government as the obstacle to our dialogue with the people.
Mm-hmm. He did say that America does not presume to know what is best for everyone. Is that a change? Do you think that we were in the past trying to impose democracy on countries that have very different systems and it would take a while to get to democracy?
The problem is not democracy. The problem is when we put conditions on countries in terms of their foreign policy as they set up their governments. And I think that's always been a problem with our policy for the past 100 years. And the president talked about colonialism, and he talked about some of the rule or the lack of rule of law in some of these countries. So I feel that he gets it in terms of supporting democratic reform in the Muslim world, and he also gets it that we as Americans probably have to lower our expectations in terms of the foreign policies of these countries while sticking to our principles in terms of global security, human rights, women's rights, religious freedom, And I felt that he definitely balanced his approach towards those issues.
Mm-hmm. We can certainly feel the strong legacy of colonialism in so many of these countries, can't we?
I think so, but like he said today, you know, you got to stop blaming others and look inside of you to deal with these problems. There's a saying in Egypt that you can have the oppressed without the oppressor, but you cannot have an oppressor without the oppressed. And so the first thing we have to do in terms of our dialogue with the Muslim world is move beyond the sense that, you know, Muslims have to be oppressed or have to be victims, if not culprits of violence. I think we need to shift the paradigm to see how we can invest in our future towards science and technology, education, and peace in the region, and deal with religion in a way that builds equality among people. I think the verses that he chose, we were very happy with those verses that he chose from the Quran, talked exactly about those principles.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the major players here who had initial response to his speech, and it indicates the problems in coming up with a road to peace. Hamas spokesman dismissing his remarks as soft diplomacy meant to brighten the image of the United States, and an Israeli government spokesman saying he heard no major surprises. A spokesman for the West Bank Settlers Council said the speech was out of touch with reality. The Muslim world is at war with the Western world. Does this indicate, you know, they heard the words, but they didn't really hear the words, and there's not very much movement on players who need to make some movement?
Exactly. Number one, those spokesmen, I believe, do not represent the sentiment of their masses.
Hmm.
I think the overwhelming majority of Palestinian and Israeli society want a two-state solution, want peace. I believe the majority of the American people want the same. So I think that the president is representing those views, not the views of those in power, unfortunately, in the Middle East. And to that extent, I think we in America have to create that interfaith cooperation constituency that supports the peace process. Because when we look at Washington, unfortunately, I think you'll probably hear the same criticism from many people on the Hill and some of the think tanks in Washington about the president's approach. It's soft, it's utopian, it doesn't really deal with the reality. I think that's what you're going to hear from many of those in Washington. They'll basically mirror exactly what you hear from some Israeli and Hamas spokespeople, unfortunately. So if I were a Palestinian, I would look at this president as the only hope for Palestinian statehood. If I were an Israeli, I would look to this president as the only hope for lasting security for the state of Israel. And if they see that, then I think we'll have progress. If not, I think the president is unfortunately going to have to deal with much more challenging times with the Israelis and some Palestinians before we see a hope for peace in that region. And that's why a popular movement for peacemaking here in America is so critical now, because I think that's going to be the overwhelming factor in bringing peace to Israelis and Palestinians.
And that's interesting. And do you think that this is the time, considering who's ruling the two sides? They're pretty conservative. Is this the time for them to realize what you just said?
If they don't realize it, then my sense is that their days are numbered in terms of their rule and their influence. Because I have hope in the people. And it's time that we as American people connect with the Israeli and Palestinian people and bypass the government and, if anything, provide grassroots diplomacy to the diplomacy that our president is trying to promote in peacemaking.
We're going to welcome phone calls. I'm sure there will be many. We're talking about President Obama's much anticipated and, for the most part, quite well-received speech in Cairo. He called for a new beginning between the United States and Muslims and said together they could confront violent extremism across the globe and advance the search for peace in the Middle East. The president said the cycle of suspicion and discord must end, and his speech was quite widely received. As you heard our guest say, it was got a standing ovation on several occasions, and people were listening very, very attentively to this. Many of you had a chance to hear the lengthy speech, 54 minutes, or you've heard excerpts from it. What do you think of this address? It has been widely anticipated, and of course, there have been a lot of websites devoted to this. People all over the world have been paying very close attention to this important address. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Rob Schroeder is answering our phones. He'll get you on hold and we'll be with you on the air soon. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Our guest is the executive director of the Muslim Public Affairs Council, Salam Al-Mariati. And we're going to be with you in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls and emails now and start our calls with Abdul from Milwaukee. Good morning, Abdul.
Good morning. How you doing?
Fine. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I want to comment about asking your guests about within Iran and Arab Saudi. And second, I want to comment first. I think what happened to Gulf area, that Middle East area, I don't blame United States for that happening. I'm blaming those leaders sitting down there and dictating. They just not just a bunch of dictators. When you go to Morocco, you go to Egypt, you go to Arab Saudi, Qatar, wherever you go, those people don't choose their own leader. And they see United States came to those leaders and telling them, we are your friends. And those people punish their own people. How those people gonna like United States, as long as they see United States and that give power to those leaders and keep punishing them. And secondly, between Arab Saudi and Iran, I think Iran much more better than Arab Saudi, because Iran people can choose their own leader. We like it or not, they choose it. They have an election coming up within 2 weeks. They can have a new president. Arab Saudi cannot have that. And for me, I'm a Muslim. If you are Muslim, somebody tell you you cannot choose your leader, and the guy tell you he's a Muslim, he's not. There's no way you can tell me, you can justify what happened Arab Saudi about Islam. You can go to one eye right away. They can you cannot justify that, because you can go right away in Quran, you can see it. God tell you what he want about Muslim, what he want about people who be leader of the other people.
Okay, Salam al-Mariati.
Well, I didn't quite comprehend the whole question. But let me try to address some of the points that I did get.
Okay.
I think, you know, God, what does God want? God wants what he says, I think, not only in the Quran, but in all of the books of God. He wants justice. He wants decency. He wants goodness. He wants freedom. And that's what, to me, this is the will of God, that are the clear principles in the Quran. And so the will of the people is inseparable from the will of God. And so when we see dictatorships in the Gulf and people opposing those dictatorships, we should support that opposition. I think what the president is talking about is it's more effective to have nonviolent opposition, and he spoke to the civil rights struggle here in America that it did not win based on violence. It won based on connecting with the founding ideals of America. And the human rights struggle in South Africa and every movement for change wins based on the ideals, not based on militancy or violent destruction. So on the one hand, I agree with the caller that there is no real democracy in the Gulf or in the Middle East, and we as an American people have to connect with those democratic movements and aspirations among the masses. And Iran, even according to Freedom House, is more democratic than the neighboring Arab countries. Iran, however, has a different set of problems that we can probably talk about later. But in terms of democracy, there are elections. However, the elections are confined to what the clerics have approved in terms of candidates. So it's still limited. It's more of a theodemocracy in Iran.
Can we talk just a little bit more about his meeting with King Abdullah in Saudi Arabia? Because evidently Iran was on the table here. Saudis and other Sunni Arab leaders in Jordan, Egypt, and the Gulf states, according to press reports, have been a little uncomfortable that Obama may be giving too much of a free hand to President Ahmadinejad, and they're concerned about the development of nuclear weapons. Do you imagine that was much discussed with Abdullah in Saudi Arabia? I guess it was yesterday. I don't know. These happen so fast. Yesterday. And what did the president have to say, if anything, about that today?
In terms of Iran or in terms of Saudi Arabia?
In terms of Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Iran and Saudi Arabia. Yeah. He didn't say anything about Iran and Saudi Arabia other than the fear of a nuclear arms race as Iran now is racing to produce nuclear weaponry. The president talked about the double standards in the world where there's the nuclear club and then there are those not in the club that are prevented. And the president mentioned an ideal that someday there will be no nuclear weapons. The issue of nuclear proliferation and adhering to the non-proliferation treaty, I think, was basically discussed in Saudi Arabia about Iran. And the fear that a number of Arab countries have towards a nuclear Iran. However, I think it would not be prudent on our part to dismiss the fact that Iran is an influential power in the Gulf with or without nuclear weapons. And we have to come to terms with that. It's been an issue in our foreign policy, again, for the last 100 years, that we've tried to contain it, and even kick out one of its leaders back in 1952 when Mohammad Mossadegh was democratically elected. We instigated a coup led by General Schwarzkopf's father and the CIA to replace him with the Shah. So this kind of meddling, interfering, I believe those days are over, but this is the memory of the Iranian people, and we have to come to terms with that kind of memory and begin to rewrite a future that has the principles of which are based on mutual interest and mutual respect, as the president keeps talking about.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Paul from West Bend. Hi, Paul.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller.
Thanks, Paul.
I've been kicking around this notion for a while, and I confess I don't know the great inner details of the mess that is the Middle East and the United States' involvement in that. But I guess I have a couple thoughts, and I was hoping to get the expert's response on that. Number one, it seems to me that Obama represents the voice of what would be my generation. I'm a 46-year-old. And although he's a Democrat, I think probably I would have voted for him if he were a Republican as well, because I think that the platform that he is trying to utilize, it's refreshing, I guess. And it makes a lot of sense, I think, to people who are just people. And the other thing I wanted to ask is, it's disturbing to me that when a president, and let's say it's Obama, communicates in a way that sort of is attempting to reach the common people, that there are so many quote-unquote political experts that want to get on one side of the fence or the other, and they seem to want to politicize everything. And yes, I think Obama's he's a political creature, of course, and he's president of the United States, but I guess I'd like to think that his approach could still be genuine and that there doesn't have to be an ulterior motive except that maybe this Middle East is a complete mess because of the things that we've tried to do, whether it's over the last 8 years or the last 20 years or 30 years, no matter how you slice it, it's still a mess. Is it possible that he's just taking an approach that makes sense, and is it reasonable for us in our generation to think, this guy makes sense and he's speaking for our generation? And I'll take your call.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I like the question. I think I personally believe that the president is driven by principles and common sense, and that's what makes great presidents. I mean, if we look back to Abraham Lincoln and John F. Kennedy and FDR, I think exactly those principles that they kept espousing and looked to serving the American people's interests in an effective way made them great presidents, and I think this president wants to do the same. Having said that, as he stated at the beginning of his speech today, his job is to keep America safe and to help it prosper. Now, from a principled standpoint, that makes sense. And also, from a principled standpoint, he believes that's the best approach towards prosperity, because if we can end war and the arms race in the Middle East and South Asia now, then imagine how much money we could save in terms of funding military machines and foreign governments that are based on autocracy, that can only win support of the people by suppressing the people. If we can change the paradigm to more interdependence, more democratic forms of governments in the Middle East, that would result in economic prosperity in America and make America even a greater superpower. And I think he sees that as well as he sees the principles and the common sense of some of these problems that have been bugging us for so many decades.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk just a little bit about Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the areas that, from reports that I've read, are troublesome for the United States is U.S. presence and NATO presence in Afghanistan, which is still a heck of a mess, and withdrawal from Iraq, which may not come soon enough to make some of the opponents of our foreign policy happy. What do you think about those areas? Do we need to withdraw soon? Do we need to figure out, or is this going to be a continuing source of antagonism toward the United States?
Well, I think regionally it will continue to be a source of antagonism because so many civilians are dying. However, I see the problem of the Taliban not fading. Definitely Al-Qaeda continues to use it as the base. That's actually, Al-Qaeda means base. And so... its base in South Asia will continue to be a source of the threat to the United States in terms of its security. However, as the president said also today, he has no ambition in producing military bases and a permanent military presence in Afghanistan. I think those are important words to also latch upon. So the problem in South Asia now is weak central governments that creates violent extremist groups or radical extremist groups that end up securing the streets. So we have to figure out a way politically to deal with this issue of weak central governments as we wean ourselves off the need to continue using military power in that region, because I don't believe that military power is going to result in the solution in South Asia, just as I don't think that there's any military solution in the Middle East, for that matter.
Hmm. We go to Kasser in Germantown. Hello.
Hi. I have a couple of comments, and basically, going back to the Axis of Evil speech, the very next day, Arab American paper came up its three Axis of Evil, and one was all the Arab leaders, State of Israel for committing these atrocities to Palestinians, and the U.S. foreign policy. And I think if the U.S. foreign policy is corrected, automatically, simultaneously, the treatment of Palestinians by the Israelis as well as the Arab leaders will realize that if they do not bring about the changes that the people of their country require and demand, and if they do not have a backing of a U.S. all these arms to suppress their own people, things will change. And then another thing that I wanted to bring up is I would like to address your audience, and I would like them, most of us are basically living in Wisconsin. How would you feel if another country picks up about a million of Muslims and brings them to from another continent and brings them to state of Wisconsin and say, okay, this southeastern part of Wisconsin is now going to be a Muslim land? And how would you react to it? I want people to put them in the, you know, think in a way how the Palestinians felt. The crimes against Jews were committed in Europe. The culprits or the criminals were Europeans, but the problem was dumped in Middle East amongst 25 or 24 to 23 Middle Eastern countries amongst all the Muslims. Why the Jews in Palestine were living a very good life? They owned businesses. They were very educated. They were doing well. The Holocaust did not happen in Middle East. It happened in Europe. It should have been resolved and solved in the European continent, not in another continent.
All right. Is that pertinent to today, do you think? Salam?
Is it pertinent? Yeah, definitely pertinent, because as the gentleman articulated, this is definitely a narrative that you hear a lot.
Yes.
Among the people, and a source of tension. And I think the president was talking about that we can't continue seeing Gaza decay under the strangulation and suffocation of this blockade. We have to allow charities to go in and help, and he even mentioned that. And we have to not only allow but be a force for Palestinian statehood. I think he's the only president in my recollection that has ever mentioned the word Palestine. I don't know if George Bush ever said Palestine. I think he may have said Palestinians or Palestinian Authority. But for a president to say Palestine, I think that's quite a step forward. Listen, this president is trying to change the foreign policy of our country. A foreign policy that has been the centerpiece in terms of the Muslim world for quite some time. Things are not going to change overnight. But what he's doing is he is setting benchmarks. He is setting the direction. He is establishing a vision for that change. And so while the problem of the Palestinians will continue and the problem of dictatorships in the Middle East will continue, as a lot of sore spots, we have to at least acknowledge the desire for change, and we have to really take this opportunity, seize the opportunity to be part of the change. I don't think we can afford as Americans to be spectators anymore on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the problems of the Muslim world, that if colonialism were to die tomorrow or whatever, foreign control of these governments were to end tomorrow, would the problems in the Muslim world go away? I think the answer is no. I think there are other intrinsic problems within the Muslim world. Number one, in terms of their relationship to the Quran and their relationship definitely that has an impact in terms of their relationship with each other. There is a suppression of women's rights. There is a problem in terms of lack of critical thinking. I think that those are problems that have nothing to do with foreign powers. If anything, those problems allow foreign powers to exploit you even further.
Hmm. And so how much self-examination is going on?
A lot. These discussions are taking place at the grassroots level. The governments do not like to talk about those kinds of discussions. And so we have to create a relationship with the Muslim world that is not just between our government and the governments over there. We have to create the third component of our relationship with the peoples.
And when you say that the president, President Obama, is trying to change foreign policy, what do you see as the major changes?
I mean, the man is nurturing the seeds of democracy in a place where there is an authoritarian rule in Egypt. So he's calling for critical thinking and the challenge of authority and that these are ideals. And so if people are hearing a president of the United States of America talk about that, then there's going to be a lot of support for that. And eventually, I think the days of dictatorship are going to fade and end, and those governments there have to figure out a way to adapt to this change for democracy in the region.
Well, that's a big statement. The days of dictatorship are going to fade.
I that's my hope, and maybe I won't see that in my lifetime, but I believe in the will of the people, and definitely someday there will be democracy in that region.
More phone calls in just one moment. Thank you, Kasser, for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. We're talking about the president's major address in Cairo, Egypt, that was listened to all over the world. 54-minute address in which he took on a number of different issues. And he has opened a very public dialogue here on some sensitive issues, actually, saying, "I'm convinced that in order to move forward, we must say openly the things we hold in our hearts and that too often are said only behind closed doors. There must be a sustained effort to listen to each other, to learn from each other, to respect one another, and to seek common ground." Here's our number. Join us if you'd like, 800-486-8655. You could also send an email, and that is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we return to phone calls. Our guest this hour is Halam Amariati, who is the executive director of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. And we go to Scott from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. Yeah. A topic that so many different aspects of it, hard to get your arms around. I'm curious as to what the rest of the world is doing. I mean, when it comes to the Middle East, it seems like the United States is required to be engaged. And there's always a discussion as what is the United States doing to help settle the Middle East conflict. But I'm curious as to what Great Britain, France, Germany, Spain, Italy, what are they doing? How are they stepping up to the plate? I mean, I travel to Germany every year, and their Muslim population is growing exponentially, and actually it's just causing a problem within the nation. And I'm wondering, are they not engaged like we are because they're afraid to be engaged? I'm just wondering why so much emphasis and so much of the weight of this issue is really placed on the United States.
Okay.
Part of the reason why so much of the weight is on the United States is because the United States decided to be the power in the region after World War II. I mean, many of the arrangements that were made with these governments were made based on American military support and American financial support for many of these governments, starting with Israel and Egypt. So as a result of America's investment in the region, we became the number one broker in the region. And France and Germany, France and England, played a backseat role to what was happening in the region. France does have some, I wouldn't say influence, but has a presence and is respected by certain governments, such as those in Lebanon and some of them in North Africa, but does not really have an influential role in the Middle East. I don't think Israel wants Europe to be involved in the Middle East. I think the Israeli government today and many of its supporters in Washington and throughout the United States want America to be the number one superpower that has ultimately the decision in how the regional arrangements are going to be made there. If you ask Palestinians or Arabs, yes, they would want the United States to get out and stay out of the region. I'm not sure if that's in our long-term interest. I think we should not stay out, but we should be involved in a much more constructive way so that we serve the interests of both Palestinians and Israelis and are not viewed as being blindly one-sided to just serve the Israelis' interests at the expense of Palestinian human rights. So I don't think we can just step back and say, hey, let the rest of the world take care of that problem, simply because the history has shown that we're just invested too much in the region. And until we wean ourselves off, again, from the military-industrial complex, arms a lot of these governments and invests billions of dollars in the region, then I'm afraid that we're kind of stuck in this position as being the one that's going to have to deal with those problems.
Let's talk about the issue of respect here. The president talked about respect and said that he considered it part of his responsibility as president of this country to fight against negative stereotypes of Islam wherever they appear. I think just the nature of this trip shows the fact that he's there. It's a much anticipated address, shows a great deal of respect from this country to the Muslim world. He also said, and I'm wondering how much just a trip like this, or if it's just too little at this point, just as Muslims do not fit a crude stereotype, America is not the crude stereotype of a self-interested empire. And there was so much discussion right after September 11 of the world not knowing who we are, the Muslim world not knowing who we are. Is this a step toward trying to let people in the world know that America is, you know, got some pretty high ideals and we don't have everything worked out, but we're not who you think we might be. And on the other hand, you're not who we think many of you are. I mean,
right.
It's an interesting way to go with his speech. And it's a big part of his presidency, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the message is loud and clear that stereotyping can go both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And really, if we want to achieve any progress, the image of America in the Muslim world is interdependent with the image of Muslims in America as well. So, and image of Islam in America. So, that message was loud and clear by the president today, and we have to deal with that issue again. I think by cutting through the red tape of the governments there and getting into the media. And having the cultural exchanges and the studies program that were outlined today, that I believe will help shift the perceptions and attitudes between the two peoples.
Thanks, Scott, for your call. Let's go next to Rich from La Crosse. Hi, Rich.
I'll get down to Brass House really quick. You know, all I can say is Barry's a handsome guy with a hot wife. But I don't really see what other street cred he has when he's still kissing Saudi and Israeli butt.
Yeah, let's have some a little more informed comments here. Let's go to Chuck next from Glenflora. Hi, Chuck.
Good morning. Just a comment here. I do agree with the guest that my aspirations are the same to improve our image in the Middle East. However, the one thing that we have constantly been fighting over the history is religion, and that is one thing that we cannot change. I don't care who the president is, who our leaders are, you cannot change religion. It has never happened. It never will. You would have to change their thinking and their minds altogether. And if you could do that, more power to you.
Their thinking, what do you mean by their thinking?
Well, you know, religion is so strong in their faith and their lies, you know, and that's what they've been battling for centuries and centuries. And for us to come in and say, hey, now we've got a new president and things are going to change and he's going to change the way the world is and also the world's image of us, I wish it would happen. But, you know, we've been trying for how many centuries and it hasn't happened yet.
So,
first of all, it has happened. As the president said today, Morocco was the first country to recognize the United States of America, and there have been many instances, in where people in the Muslim world were very supportive and had aspirations of reaching American ideals in their own countries. So I don't think the issue is religion per se, but the role of religion is important, and I agree with the caller. We have to be much more clear in terms of where religion is going to play a role in public affairs and governance. Definitely, and here we need to have a discussion about religion and secularism. Religion is not supposed to create theocracies. In Islam, there is no clergy. So these state clergies
of various states are just that. They are the clerics of those particular states. There's no pope in Islam. And there's no one mosque or one church in Islam. So we have to separate this notion of religion now dominating other people, one religion dominating other religions in the world. And that is actually an issue within Islam and is a discussion in terms of how to deal with religious freedom. There's a Quranic verse that's very important that says, "Let there be no compulsion in matters of faith." And this is in chapter 2, verse 256. I consider that to be the First Amendment clause in the Quran. So there's a lot of commonality between the Muslim world and America in terms of these principles. And America also is not void of religion. I mean, we're one of the most religious countries in the world. And religion does influence our lives and does influence the way we shape our laws, let alone our morality. So in my opinion, there's a lot more common than there is different between the two peoples. And when we look at the texts of the Quran and the Bible and the Old Testament, as the president did today, you find that basically the values are identical. The principles are the same. You believe in one God, you believe in one humanity, and you try to do good in this life, and then you leave the rest to your Creator. But definitely there should be no one religion that dominates other religions through the instrument of government.
I like that philosophy. You try to do good in this life. It should guide all of us, huh? Thanks, Chuck, for the call. Nell is next from Brookfield. Hi, Nell.
Hi. Well, apparently I'm on the same thing about the religion thing. But I think differently from the Bible. The Quran, you know, really tells you how to live almost every minute of your day. And I didn't hear, and I might have missed it, the president say anything about women's rights and women's equality. And until that happens in these Arab nations that are so controlled by Islam, and the Quran actually says, you know, that tells the rules of what a woman is supposed to do, and submit, 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 and the man can do just about anything he wants to her, and it's in there. And I think our president, I feel, should have said, until women are held equally in both power and in honor and respect, there will be no peace, and there will be no prosperity, and there will be no forward movement in these countries.
Well, he did talk about women in the speech in terms of saying, I reject the view of some in the West that a woman who chooses to cover her hair is somehow less equal, but I do believe that a woman who is denied an education is denied equality. Have you heard him speak more extensively on this particular issue, Salam?
This is the first time I heard him talk specifically about women's rights, and I thought it was a breath of fresh air, because I believe that we are not going to have reform in the Muslim world unless and until we have the emancipation of women in the Muslim world. And I'm not talking about, you know, whether that, you know, how they want to dress or what they want to do in their day-to-day lives. I'm pro-choice when it comes to the headscarf. But what I'm talking about is the right of Muslim women to be involved in the public affairs, the right to education, the right to health care, the right to divorce, the right to inheritance. All these issues have caused a violation of their rights using religion, and we cannot have that if we believe that religion is supposed to promote justice.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a whole reform movement within the Muslim communities, and the Muslim community here in America is very important in that issue in terms of looking at Islam in a way that preserves the equality and the rights of Muslim women. I think the president was speaking to that. Now, it's interesting that he spoke from Cairo, because not only is Cairo an influential city with respect to the Muslim world, it's a formal capital of the Muslim world, but it is also a place where Al-Azhar was founded, and that's a university that produced Muslim reformers like Sheikh Muhammad Abdu. And he, back in the 19th century, was calling for the education of Muslim women equal to that of Muslim men. So we've had this strains of reform in the Muslim world for quite some time. It needs to be nurtured. It needs to be developed. It needs to be formulated into a real movement. And we see pockets of that in various parts of the Muslim world. So I agree with the caller that there's a problem with the issue of Muslim women. I disagree with the caller that it is rooted in the Quran. It is actually rooted in the exploitation of the Quran and some of the understandings, or misunderstandings, actually, of some people who have mm-hmm. power and influence.
Thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate your analysis of the president's important speech in Cairo. Salam al-Maratari, al-Marayati, our guest this hour, executive director of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Rob Schroeder for production. This is the Ideas Network.